Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the decision by Scopa to put the road accident fund under the microscope. We've seen there have been a lot of reports related to the road accident fund of late across various different challenges that they have been dealing with. We're going to speak to the chairperson there on the Standing Committee on Public Accounts around that and get a sense of what it is that they are looking at there in particular. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the amended transformation fund proposals that were put forward by the DTIC. We're going to get a sense of what the latest adjustments could potentially look like and what we make of them. We also have a conversation with the team at Allan Gray taking a look at investing in the travel sector and what that could look like in 2025. And then because it is Wednesday, we've got an executive lounge conversation. We're going to be chatting to the Sub-Saharan Africa CEO of the Big Five duty-free business, getting to know him a little bit better.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show, as always, with a sense of how markets have been faring throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by PSG Old Oaks portfolio manager Skalk Lowe to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Skalk, lovely to have you on the show, as always. Lovely to catch up. The Rand a little bit weaker than the last time you and I spoke. Markets having somewhat of a better day today. They didn't have the strongest start to the week. What's happening today?
Jimmy, if your glass had something in it, it was half empty. half empty. Because man, oh man. I mean, we're looking at the JSE 1.3% up. The resources up 2.6% for today, and the rest, pretty much everything in the green. And I'm getting the rand is just weaker, and the markets are looking somewhat. It was a fabulous day. We had a big retracement in resources. Yes, we did have an operational update from Goldfields this morning, and that did look good. It seems like they're on track to produce the goods in an environment where you want to be producing the goods. But I felt today we went shopping. I mean, it's not Black Friday yet, but I mean, I really felt we went shopping today, because when I look at the JSE today and the movements, yes, the resources did have a recovery, and it was a solid green day. But when we look at the actual, you know, retailers inside, you know, Spar today 4.5%, the Fushini Group 5.2% up, Truworths 5.1% up, even Woolies that usually struggles 2.4% up, and even if you look at let's call it the food retailers, Shoprite up over 1% today, Pick and Pay 1.5%, Mr. Price 3.5%. I know Mr. Price is not a food retailer, but it's a really solid recovery day for a sector that's been struggling in 2025, and today is as if there was just a bit of a switch that went on and say we need to be buying some retailers.
I was going to ask you about that, Skalk. I was going to ask you about the retailers, and I mean, they have, by comparative standards, underperformed when compared to some of the other sectors. And yes, the anomaly that is within the resources sector makes sense to kind of exclude that. But the retailers really haven't had the best time of the year. Is it general optimism that now we're suddenly finding favor in the retailers? Is there something more? I mean, we haven't gotten numbers out of the retailers. We're not in the middle of their earnings season. So why the sudden, hey, let's get into retailers?
Yeah, it's been an area. The food retailers, Mr. Shoprite, it's gone pretty much from strength to strength. Pick and Pay, we know the struggles that Pick and Pay has got. And Sean Somers made it clear they're only going to be breaking even at around about 2028. Boxer, been doing well, but you can see it's the clothing retailers has really struggled. They had a fantastic 2024, and then it was all this hype around two-pot system. There's going to be X amount of billion that's going to be flowing into the South African economy, and most of that money is going to be caught by these clothing retailers. And then we went into 2025, and it was just headwind upon headwind upon headwind. The Temos and the Sheens really eating into these turnovers. But I felt that we got to a point, lately, where it just it's a little bit overdone. When you look at something like a Mr. Price, for example, I mean, they're currently sitting at a forward P of 11 point something. You know, some of these other retailers are now single digit forward P's. And yes, they do have their challenges, but man, oh man, I just think they were a little bit cheap. And yeah, I think today was one of those days where some fund manager clearly out there, or maybe two fund managers out there, clearly felt that it's a little bit overdone and it's time to do some, hey, I'm going to use it, shopping.
Skulk, is that the case for all markets? Is that the case for international markets? I mean, I'm looking at markets like the Nikkei that were down about 2.5% today, but we've also been kind of keeping an eye on other markets. I mean, earlier on, a couple of weeks ago, we started to see a bit of a turnaround in the luxury space, the likes of LVMH and the Kering Groups reporting more positivity from their perspective. Is it potentially just a turn of sentiment that might be taking a little bit longer because of how many geopolitical factors we've had to contend with, but all in all, seemingly there might be some positivity that seems to be coming out?
The general perception of luxury goods is usually that it's as the word says, luxury goods, and people will only be spending at these call it retailers when they have money. But that's not the case. I think the period in COVID was a case in point, when we were sort of locked up and it was a really difficult scenario. These luxury good retailers did extremely well, because people don't know that it's actually quite a defensive to buy these luxury goods. A Cartier watch, I know, is an expensive thing and it's not something that most probably you and I will be able to afford. But I mean, there is a lot of people out there that buy these as a sort of a defensive, like buying a Kruger coin, they will buy a Cartier watch. Back to you know, where we are. I think, no doubt, especially the US, we're sitting at elevated levels, and we've seen that some of these, let's call it tech AI counters, they're spending a lot of money. I mean, I can't remember when last I've seen this many billions being used for development, research, and those kind of things. And yes, I think eventually it will pay off. But I mean, in the shorter term, when you're trading at these elevated levels, you need to produce the goods. And if you're going to miss targets, then markets might react. So I think for the listeners out there, my message today would be, go back to your portfolio. I mean, don't go and sell out or try and front the market. Just make sure that you're still within your, let's call it, risk profile. If you feel that the market could have a pullback of 15, even 20%, and you'll still be comfortable, then fine, you're in the right investment, let's call it, vehicle. If not, hey, maybe it's just time to look at some profit taking.
Skulk, which sectors would you then be looking at if you are looking at getting involved in the markets? I mean, understandably, as you said, some of the markets might still experience a pullback. We might still have a bit of a deeper retracement on some of the markets. Which sectors then start to, or historically perhaps, might have done well in the festive period? We know you and I have spoken about the Santa rally and the Christmas rally before. We're heading closer towards that time. And between now and that time, there's an interest rate decision from South Africa. There's one from the United States. There's still a couple of other data points that are coming out. What do we typically see as we go towards the tail end of the year becomes attractive?
I'm so glad you're preempting that, because I mean, December month has been notoriously the best month for markets. I mean, that's just case in point, and that's why they call it a Santa rally. You know, add into a mix that you want to be buying shares when interest rates are decreasing, and it currently, when you look at the forecast, yes, it's not your 80 or 90%. When you look at the CME Fed tool, they're still forecasting a close to 70% probability that we're going to see another rate cut coming from the Fed this month. So in a decreasing interest rate environment, it is always good to be looking at stocks. And I think stats are supporting let's call it a positive environment. I do think, and I'm worried about the levels we're currently trading at. You ask me where would I find, there's two things where you could do in your share portfolio when you are a little bit worried. You can either go to cash, and that is like selling out, and now you'll be missing out on any further growth. Or you could move to stocks which is notoriously a little bit more defensive. Your healthcare stocks, your sin stocks, things like the Anheuser-Busch, the British American Tobacco Companies, the gambling type of stocks. Those are the things you can look at. For me now, I look at stocks that's been really underperforming this year, and the retail is, funny enough, is an area where I felt that we did stay behind. And going into the festive season, in an environment where you've seen a sector stay behind, which could benefit in this, let's call it, festive season, I do find a few opportunities. And like I said, the likes of the Mr. Prices are not currently looking attractive. And you know, a ShopRite is always a solid under the ball.
Skulk, I want to take a look at the Rand while we do have time. We have touched on it in this conversation, but going into kind of the tail end of the year, I wanted to get your thoughts around potentially seeing more than just 17 Rand and 5 cents. I know we spoke about it. I want to be optimistic that we'll break that 17 Rand level. It seems as though every single time we try, every single time we get closer, something happens, risk sentiment shifts, markets are looking at things differently. And I want to look at that now in the context of the likes of S&P and Fitch. We know that around November, December-ish, we do have another ratings review that we're due for. And potentially, I mean, according to Bank of America, at least, that Standard & Poor's could potentially increase our credit rating agency, or our credit rating rather, as a sovereign. That would be historic, because we've been technically junk status for quite some time.
Yeah. So the first point on that, I think we should not be thinking that S&P will, in November, with their November meeting, adjust us from being junk status to not being junk status. We need to adjust three notches. So we'll still have time. Bank of America brought out a wonderful report. Well, actually brought out two reports this month. Earlier this month, they were talking about, and this is where I do agree, they were talking about us improving and could go out of junk status before the next elections. Now that gives us enough time to move this three notches. I think us going out of the grey listing environment's already been positive, and it's a move in the right direction. So things are definitely improving on a local front. You're talking about the Rand, and I'm going to ask you, and I had your colleagues Raik a few evenings ago, and Simon today. I ask him, do you know the song Dim Bones?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So you know it's a nursery song, and it's the hip bone is connected. I'm not going to be singing again. Definitely not. But it's the hip bone that's connected to the backbone, and the backbone to the neck bone to the head bone. It's, I think what has shown us the past is, call it 72 hours in the markets. It's markets and tensions. We've seen markets being worried yesterday, and there was a bit of a sell-off. And a sell-off in two things. Firstly, we've seen a sell-off in emerging market currencies. Not just South Africa. You're talking about the Rand. Not just South Africa. You look at the Mexican peso, Brazilian real. Most of the emerging market currencies were sold off yesterday. And also, emerging market equities were sold off. But that didn't stop there. It was equities in general. So it was a risk-off environment where equities were sold off, NASDAQ, Dow, S&P 500. But where did the money go? 3 weeks ago, if we were sitting in an environment where the ISM Manufacturing Index came out, eighth consecutive retraction in the index. That's bad. But it's now below 50, which means it's actually contracting. The manufacturing in the US. Usually, you know, if it's 3 weeks ago, we would have had a weakening dollar, and we would have had the gold price run from $3,000 to $4,000. That's typically what we've seen. But yesterday, it was sort of a sanity prevailed. We've had all these currencies and markets being sold off. And where did they go? They went into the good old dollar. So I think I still believe that the rand is extremely undervalued, even at current levels. And yeah, your 1705, is this as good as it gets? I still think we're going to be breaking that 1717 mark, and we most probably will do it before the end of the year. But that's just me. I mean, that's where I'm standing. But I mean, if markets do find more volatility towards the end of the year, yeah, don't be surprised if we see further weakness in the rand.
Glass half full. That's how we should be looking at the markets, and that's how we should be approaching the end of the year. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to portfolio manager at PSG Wealth, Old Oak Skulk Low, for joining us. Take a look at market movements, market sentiment, and perhaps market opportunity.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Almost 5 years ago, the pandemic crippled the global travel sector, and many thought we would never travel again. But as the holiday season approaches, millions of travellers are packing their bags and contributing to the sector's ongoing recovery. Tune into the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray Portfolio Manager Talia Petosis joins the show to explore some of the compelling opportunities in global travel for long-term investors. Brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorised FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The key number is 300 billion rand. That is the discrepancy that we could potentially be dealing with from a balance sheet perspective, or the difference rather from a balance sheet perspective where it relates to the road accident fund. There were some liabilities on the road accident fund's balance sheet around the 2019-2020 financial year that were written down to 34 billion rand in the 2020-2021 year, and it seems as though we're going back to 300 to 400 billion rand because of accounting adjustments. Now, this has obviously prompted some concern from the Standing Committee on Public Accounts within Parliament, and we're going to take a look at this and take a look at what it is that they are going to be looking at from their perspective. I'm joined on the line by the chairperson of the Standing Committee of Public Accounts, Songezo Zibi, to take a look at this and see what you make of it. Chair, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the scope from a scoper perspective around what it is you are looking at where it relates to the road accident fund.
Good evening, and thank you very much for having me on. So we're looking at the financial management of the road accident fund from the year 2019-2020 through to maybe a month or two ago, effectively. That is because every time the Road Accident Fund has come to Parliament and we have asked for information around its finances, it has either been accurate or misleading, which made it difficult for us to understand the true financial state of the Road Accident Fund. And in the course of the last few months, the past year actually, and the last few weeks of this inquiry, we have uncovered much of what is wrong with the road accidents finances, its accounting practices, and the efficiency of its operations. I can't even use the word efficient at all because it is so inefficient.
Now, Chair, what you have uncovered versus what we've also been made aware of in the public domain does cause for some serious concern. I mean, aside from this significant accounting adjustment that is set to take place, which effectively means then that we've just undone the last 4 years of accounting work. There's also the matter of the fact that there are some bank accounts that have come to light of recent where monies have been allegedly found from a road accident fund perspective. These are obviously areas of concern, especially because we're dealing with public finances here.
Yeah, let me first explain the accounting problem in a couple of sentences. And that is, you know, if the road accident fund is responsible for paying for damages, loss of future income, future medical expenses of road accident victims in South Africa. Now, it relies on an actuarial estimate. So every time there's an accident that happens in South Africa, actuaries make an estimation of how much of that will result in a claim for the road accident fund. That goes into its contingent liability on the balance sheet. The road accident fund, by change of accounting policy, simply pretends that calculation does not matter. It's immaterial. It doesn't exist, which is how this 300 plus billion potential liability became 30 billion. The second problem, of course, is that it means the finance minister does not have reliable information to inform a policy decision around the funding of the road accident fund. And that has been the case since 2020 because the road accident fund has been persisting. But we've also realized there are some discomforting practices at the road accident fund. They would open and close bank accounts fairly often and without following procedure or proper authorization because they're trying to avoid litigants attaching those bank accounts. But also the amount of money spent on legal fees per claim, the value per claim, for instance, has gone up by 70% because the road accident fund still spends over 40 billion on 63,000 claims instead of the 253,000 it was able to settle 4 years ago with the same amount of money. That's huge financial leakage that should not be allowed to continue.
Chair, perhaps you can give us a bit of an understanding from a scoper perspective as to what outcomes are possible within the Standing Committee. Once this investigation has concluded and you've satisfied that you've got the relevant information you need, what sorts of actions can be taken from the recommendations you can put forward?
Several things. First of all, we can refer some cases for prosecution. We can commission through the Special Investigating Unit and the Auditor General forensic investigations that may result in prosecutions. We will consider whether certain individuals should not refund public monies through the quality or malicious decisions they took at the Road Accident Fund. That, of course, taxpayers' money, that they should pay that money back. We'll also make what we call systemic recommendations. So one of the examples is that it's become clear to us that successive boards of the Road Accident Fund were composed of board members who should have never been board members of any entity to begin with. And there is no guideline in government or the Department of Transport as in terms of what it takes to become a board member of an entity like that. So we will start establishing some guidelines, minimum standards on what the state needs out of board members of entities such as the Road Accident Fund, which has not been existing before.
Chair, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the... You touched on the purpose and the intention behind the Road Accident Fund existing in today's landscape. We've seen reports that the Road Accident Fund has paid out to individuals that are non-South African residents, and that's a debate that we can potentially have at another time. But for an organization that receives on average 4 to 5 billion rand in revenues on a monthly basis, this is at least according to the Road Accident Fund themselves, surely there should be, or at least according to the interim chair rather of the Road Accident Fund, surely we should be handling these public finances a little bit better. Are you going to be looking to put forward potential oversight recommendations as well if you find that that is necessary?
No, absolutely. In fact, it is necessary. To give you a sense, the average value per claim has gone up due to the collapse of its internal systems by 70%. There is absolutely no reason why it has, apart from the fact that the process is poorly managed these days. Like the Road Accident Fund used to settle over 250,000 claims with just over 43 billion they now can only do 63,000. And that means that's incredible financial leakage. The second is that the amount of money they spend on legal fees per claim is insane. It has quadrupled over the last 3 years. So we're going to make recommendations in terms of issues like that so that every rand that South Africans contribute to the Road Accident Fund stretches as far as possible. We need to get back to that 250,000 plus number for the same amount of money. Then we'll know we have succeeded.
Well, we wish you and the committee all of the best in uncovering the information that you need to and gathering the information that you need to. We look forward to seeing the outcomes of the Standing Committee of Public Accounts on this particular matter. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. That was the chairperson of the Standing Committee of Public Accounts taking us through their investigation into the Road Accident Fund and what it is that they're going to be looking at.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, the DTIC recently published a revised version of their 100 billion rand transformation fund proposal. This was discussed by the Minister, of course, of the DTIC, that is Minister Park Stowe. And following that, there seems to be a bit more clarity around what this new and improved transformation fund could potentially look like. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of Unconventional CA, Hiten Keshav, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Hiten, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start the conversation perhaps with what the new improvements are. I know that the document has been very difficult to come by in the public spaces, and so we might not cover all of the adjustments and proposed changes, but can you give us a sense of what it is that you've been picking up on?
Jimmy, thank you for having me on the show. Yes, certainly. Look, in actual fact, the improvements really just relate around governance matters and how the government is trying to state that they're going to have independent parties on the board to have administration and oversight over this fund, and so that there's an independent viewpoint to avoid any forms of discrepancies arising in how that money is managed itself. Beyond that, it's very, I would say, vague in terms of what this fund is actually going to do and how it's actually going to benefit the impact of small businesses and our economy itself.
Now, some of the conversations that we've had around this particular transformation fund have centered around, as you alluded to, where the funds are going to be deployed, how they're going to be deployed. But one of the conversations that we have almost had quite quietly is the fact that at the end of the day, this will still remain a centralized fund that will be distributed the same way or in a similar manner to how some of the other centralized funds are currently managed by the government. Is this model, this setup, the best way to go about with this particular fund?
Oh, I certainly don't think so in that regard. If you look at it on what the objective of this fund is, essentially it's telling you that if you're a corporate citizen and you want your BEE points for enterprise and supplier development, drop a pool of cash into this fund, we'll give you your points, and Bob's your uncle, and move forward on that end. What that is essentially doing is taking away accountability behind the true essence of what transformation and BEE actually stands for, from an empowerment perspective. Now, if you look at the challenges this country is facing right now, unemployment, youth unemployment sitting over 45%, our total unemployment sitting at around 33%. There's this big hoorah, that small businesses drive new job creation. Now, handing this over and creating no accountability in the hands of corporates to actually be good corporate citizens from an ESG and SDG perspective and really empowering our small economy on that end, how are we actually going to truly transform all these challenges our country has, knowing the current economic state our country currently sits in? And if you just look at our economic activity in the markets itself, compared now to last year itself, look at the confidence our economy had and how the markets rallied last year. Take the retail sector, for example, just remove gold, platinum, all the precious metals. Our growth in our economy in the markets is sitting probably around 5-6%, excluding that. Now, ask yourself, is government really going to then take 100 billion rand and really resolve and resurrect what's going on here?
Hiten, I want to take a look at the other side of the conversation that I've had a couple of these conversations where there isn't a lack of willingness to participate in the transformation fund. There's not a lack of willingness from a commitment perspective to say we will commit the 3% or whatever it is. There's more a concern around deployment, implementation, and how the funds will be used. How then do we start to draft a framework that is acceptable, not just to those that are contributing towards the fund, but as a framework that actually speaks to the transformative nature of what we're trying to achieve here?
I think you use a good word there, framework. And one of the biggest things that's missing when it comes to these type of implementations, especially in the enterprise and supply development sector, is monitoring and evaluation. There's no systematic framework that can diagnose where entrepreneurs are. Okay, after that, what are the development areas that need to be focused on? What solutions now need to be provided? How are those solutions now transforming those entrepreneurs' businesses and growing and scaling them? In today's dynamic and landscape, none of that measurement indicators are there. And I think if we have a proper framework and a measurement tool, whether it be a digital platform or something that guides implementation providers on how that is implemented, then we will have a clear, transparent overview on what is taking place, whether money is being provided in the form of soft loans to these SMMEs and being recouped back, whether the money is being implemented in the form of training and interventions to help upskill these businesses so that they can become investment ready and grow and scale their businesses. And I believe if that part formulates into that framework and into that document a lot more clearly and logically, it'll allow for greater transparency. Furthermore to that, the biggest question you're going to ask is, from a government perspective, if you're going to have 100 billion rand, how are you going to choose your service providers, knowing that this has been ongoing for about more than 2 decades now? Who are the service providers that you're going to hold key that have been on the ground dealing with these entrepreneurs on a day-to-day basis, knowing what the challenges are, to then guide and educate and help them make best use of that funds in the way that's going to yield the right results economically?
Hey, Ted, before I let you go, and at the risk of sounding a lot more negative than what I actually am, I firmly believe this transformation fund has the potential to do an immense amount of good. We have, as a country, come out of repeated commissions of inquiry for things that didn't go as planned, and hopefully this is not another one of those scenarios at the end of the day, because that's the last thing that we can afford. That being said, how do we then ensure that from a deployment perspective or from a consultation perspective or where whatever perspective we're looking at it from, how do we ensure that we avoid repeating the mistakes of the past?
Well, I think my view is if we could have something similar to how the B20s with an open collaborative stakeholder engagement with parties that are already involved in the sector, and everyone is allowed to have their contribution and part and play in it, both from a private sector and public sector perspective, I think then we can certainly say all parties have had their say and there's a viewpoint collectively around what should be done. I don't think you're wrong in that it can transform and really do good things. I'm just concerned that in the hands in which it is handled, this doesn't become a network of pals hiring pals, for a better word, and ends up being a commission inquiry that we have to go through 5 years down the line.
Hiten, would there be benefit in potentially outsourcing the entire fund, managing it independently of whether it's the private sector, the public sector? Would there be any merit towards exploring that perspective, or does it require, much like what we've been seeing, public-private participation and partnership to ensure that accountability goes beyond just the conversation and actually translates into the fund?
So I don't think there's no merit in outsourcing the fund, but then it makes no difference to what the current BEE codes allows for. In some cases, you'll find corporate entities provide interest or deploy the ESD funds to capital managers who then deploy those funds to small businesses. So in that instance, there's no difference in the model itself. I think what the government is trying to do here, in my honest opinion, is probably try and get this money into to help resolve certain pressures that they are facing financially with their budget constraints currently, and find a loop around this to utilize to effectively handle certain departmental budgets that need to be handled over a period of time on that end. So I guess we're sitting in a chicken and egg situation where you go private, it can be possible, but it makes no difference to how the BEE codes currently provide for that anyway.
I suppose this is why that framework is important, to unpack what it is that we're going to be doing here and what ring fencing we're going to be doing for these funds. We're going to have to wait and see how this shapes up. For now, I suppose we still have a lot more questions than answers around the Transformation Fund. We're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. However, thanks so much to the Chief Executive Officer of Unconventional CA, Hiten Keshev, for joining us to take a look at the revised transformation fund that has been put forward by the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. I don't think anyone needs a reminder of what life was like 5 years ago, certainly not the travel and hospitality sectors of the world. They virtually ground to a halt overnight and almost didn't survive. Fast forward to today and the story looks very different. In fact, some of these companies have shown quite the turnaround. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with portfolio manager at Alan Gray, Talia Potosis. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of the travel sector. Talia, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's take a look at the changes we've seen in the travel space or in the travel sectors over the last 5 years, perhaps even longer than that. I suppose the last 5 years seemingly might be the most important.
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, the last 5 years has been very interesting in that you had this huge travel downturn where, you know, as you say, you know, travel ground to a halt. And it felt for some time when we were in that COVID period that maybe, you know, it was never going to recover. And actually, a lot of listed travel shares took a real beating. And across, I guess, the independent hotel space, you saw a lot of hotels going into business rescue, needing to close, needing to be bought out by bigger hotel groups. But then over a much longer trajectory, you know, what's happened to travel? Well, I mean, it's changed enormously. If you think back to the 1990s versus now, you know, travel planning was such an arduous process. You know, you had to visit a physical travel agent, you know, accumulate physical inventories of paper maps, guidebooks, travelers' checks, entertainment brochures. And now, and I think this is part of why the recovery has been as fast as it has been and has rebounded as strongly as it has been since COVID, is it's so easy to book a holiday. I mean, I could literally get off the phone with you now, and I mean, as long as there's enough money loaded to my credit card, or as long as my overdraft allows it, I could go and maybe in the next hour, you know, plan an itinerary, you know, based on, you know, online recommendations, log into a platform like booking.com and book out the entire thing and be done with it, you know what I mean, within an hour. So, you know, you compare that to what travel booking was like, you know, 15 years ago, and, you know, it was weeks of research and visiting those physical travel agents and maybe even calling people overseas to get recommendations, you know, finding, you know, specific meeting points. Yeah, so I think part of the fact that it's so easy now that everything is at our fingertips has meant that the sector has rebounded as you know, more quickly than what many would have imagined.
Talia, do you think this is part of what gives the Booking.coms, the Hotels.coms of the world an edge in the market, understanding that convenience for the end customer is a priority? And is this kind of how we're seeing the travel sector move in general?
Definitely. I mean, to hone in on Booking.com in particular, because that's actually a share that we've owned for quite a while, I would say, you know, their competitive edge is very much in letting the customer choose. So letting the customer curate their own holiday and doing so regardless of the unit economics of that particular accommodation offering to Booking.com. So, for example, you know, as budget travel has gained popularity, Booking.com has increased their offerings into, you know, much cheaper travel accommodations. So you can book apart hotels, which is essentially a cross between apartment and a hotel. So it has all kind of the quasi features of a hotel with the convenience of a service department or any sort of alternative offering. You can book a campsite. You can book a glass and ice igloo from which to watch the Northern Lights in Finland, sort of whatever you want. So it's that convenience factor. And then it's just letting the customer choose and curate whatever they want and allowing it at pricing points that the customer can choose to buy into. And just on that point, it's really interesting. I mean, we think of, I guess, hotels as being quite expensive nowadays. But if you look at the average booking rate, so the average daily booking rate across Booking.com's platform in dollar terms, the average booking is virtually unchanged now versus 10 or 15 years ago. And that's because people have increasingly moved into more budget sort of accommodation styles, and Booking.com has been there to allow them that flexibility so that they don't have to stay in a high-end hotel, so that they can sort of shop down as their wallet allows them to. So yeah, I would say it's that convenience. It's allowing the consumer to pay via their own local apps, to transact in their own language, their own currency, to name their own price, also to have the option to cancel at no fee. That was actually something that Booking.com introduced quite early, and they forced the rest of the travel market, they forced their competitors eventually to follow on and to offer the same options.
So Talia, how then from an investment point of view do you start to look at a stock like Booking.com? What are some of the factors? Are these factors that you're mentioning now some of the fundamentals that lead an investor to then say, perhaps this is a good business, a business model I can believe in, and perhaps a business model I should be investing in for the long term?
Yeah, so I mean, there are quite a few factors we look at. There are many businesses, you know, that have a nice business model and offer convenience to a consumer, but we don't necessarily, you know, invest in all of them. And I think one key difference with Booking.com is they generate a lot of cash flow, and they return that cash flow to shareholders. So that's a big one. And then even though, you know, you can think they're quite big, they've got a lot of scale. And I mean, just on that scale, I mean, they've got 31 million accommodation room listings. And if you think about, you know, in 2024, they sold 1.1 billion room nights. Sometimes, you know, that sort of scale, you know, as an investor, you're looking at it and thinking, well, how's the share possibly going to grow? You know, it's so big, it's so dominant right now. So we look at growth opportunities. And there, you know, I think one thing that has encouraged us is Booking.com is always moving into new spaces. So they now have a flights offering that's gaining a lot of traction. They're loading tours and activities, so experiences, onto their website so that you can actually plan out an entire itinerary, you know, not just booking the actual hotel room, but now start, you know, bolting on an activity, an experience. So they're essentially capturing more of the consumer's wallet over time, you know, with those kinds of initiatives. Yeah, and then another thing is obviously we're thinking about, okay, in the travel space, you know, it's plausible that there could be another travel downturn. You know, every few years there is, you know, and even recently with some of the geopolitical conflict and geopolitical noise that was taking place, there were some areas of the globe that were certainly seeing less travel demand. So there, what's quite important to us is taking a look at, okay, how much of their cost base is variable? So how much could they flex down costs in a travel downturn? And there, they actually have really strengthened the business enormously in the last few years and by doing away with fixed costs. And one way they've done this is by being really controlled in terms of employee headcounts. And also in some area of the business, for example, you know, their call center agents, you know, they've replaced a lot of them with chatbots, which, you know, is a whole separate conversation in and of itself, because we can just debate, you know, is that positive for humanity? But it's positive for the company in terms of their cost base, because you don't have to pay a chatbot who's chatting to a customer because they want to change some part of their itinerary.
Navigating the complex world of the global travel sector and identifying areas of opportunity for investment within that space. Thank you so much to Talia Potosis for those insights and for the time. She's the portfolio manager at Allen Gray, joining us to take a look at the travel sector and how to navigate investing in it. The segment was brought to you by Allen Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing, Allen Gray is an authorized financial services provider. With over 5 decades of investing experience, Allen Gray remains focused on building long-term wealth for clients by pursuing long-term returns without taking undue risk. Allen Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allen Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday, and this week's executive is a special guest. For those of you who have ever walked through OR Tambo International, particularly the International Departures section, you might have seen a little store called the Big Five Duty Free. It's not little at all. In fact, it's probably the largest by size in that area. We're going to be speaking to the company's CEO for Sub-Saharan Africa, Lloyd Mhlanga, and getting to know him a little bit better. Lloyd, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. How does a young Lloyd at 18 go from being a temporary cashier to being the CEO of this business?
Hi, Jimmy. Great to be on the show. Interesting journey. Since 25 years ago, I started as a packer. Quickly, I moved to be a cashier. I moved again to be a supervisor. A few years down the line, I became an assistant manager. Then later the years, I became a manager. In 2019, I was promoted as a general manager of the company. And most recently, I've been promoted to be a CEO. So I can say, mostly, you know, when you have a vision to lead and being inspired by your leaders and great attitude towards your work.
Lloyd, what drew you to this business? I mean, you started out, as you said, as a packer within the business. What then kept you within the business to say, you know what, this is a business I really could see myself growing in. It's a business I really believe in, and it's a business I really want to be a part of.
I think when you draw inspiration from your leaders, when you look at the organization itself, how it directs their employees, how it inspires their employees in terms of training, in terms of schooling, bursaries, and all that. It actually gives you the a little bit of a taste of, I can see myself here. I can see myself growing.
Lloyd, now that you've grown to where most people dream of growing to, how do you stay motivated at that level? How do you continue to on a daily basis get up and say, you know what, I can finally make the changes that I've always wanted to see happen in this business? What continues to drive you today?
My drive is my family. I think to know what kind of a person you are and understanding yourself totally, it actually keeps you grounded. It actually keeps you motivated to want to do more. I've got a son and a daughter. My daughter, she's a child living with disabilities. And I think since 8 years ago, I've got the child. It actually kept me wanting to live more and wanting to experience more. And my son, he's actually 15 years old as well. They keep me going. And my wife, for motivating me every day.
Lloyd, what is that like? What is that balance like between family and work, between spending time with the kids, but also understanding that you want to be present in their lives and not just spending time as a way to get away from work?
It is quite challenging, but you know, sometimes you give it a little bit of take a little bit of a walk around the complex, clear your head, always try and have a clear mind.
Is walking the best way for you to clear your mind? Do you find that that works best? Do you enjoy any sports or any other activities?
Walking, it's my best, and some of the times I play soccer. So it's, I always try and keep myself active and motivated.
Are we playing five-a-side soccer here? Are we playing full field? What kind of soccer are we talking about here?
I really try to play a full field soccer. Because, you know, where I stay in Benoni, it's actually just opposite. There's a field where I can just go there and exercise. So I'll join the team and keep myself a little bit fit.
What's it like staying in Benoni? How's the traffic?
Traffic acting. You know how it is lately with the traffic lights off every now and then. And you're sitting in traffic and trying to think how your day looked like while you're driving. You see the flight landing and departing. And he's like, yeah, this is where I'm going.
Lloyd, let's go back to work for a second. And I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this. Why is it that duty-free stores charge so much more than everywhere else? Is it a thing? I mean, it happens in every airport, everywhere in the world. Why is that?
I wish I have a clear answer to you, but you see, we can stay competitive in terms of sub-Saharan countries, but in terms of Europe, sometimes it can be difficult to be competitive with the pricing. But I wish I can give you a clear answer today.
Maybe one day we'll find out what the real reason is. Lloyd, what is the one thing that, for you, you wish for your children to know? For your son and your daughter to be able to know that this is what Dad wants to share with us?
Education is key. That is my number one. Always know what you want, dream big, and you are not limited.
You bring up education, Lloyd. You've spent quite a bit of time ensuring that education forms a critical part of your career at every point in your career. I mean, we've touched on the different roles that you've had, but along the way, you've also then dedicated yourself above and beyond that to actually continuing to improve your educational qualifications. Why is that?
To keep informed, and you know, always you have to sharpen your business acumen. So you cannot just be stagnant. Try and get more knowledge, advance in terms of your education, so that you'll be able to grow.
Lloyd, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around the young businessman in South Africa. I mean, you started out very much, as you said, as a young businessman, as an 18-year-old, as someone who didn't have any confirmation that one day there would be the CEO of potentially one of the largest businesses that we see in the space that you operate in. Young business people out there that might be wanting to start up businesses, that want to, or that might have started businesses, that are looking for motivation to keep going when the times get difficult. How would you say they approach that?
Jimmy, for a typical guy like me, coming from a dusty village of Agincourt Trust in Mpumalanga, I can say, do not let the size of your village define the size of your dreams. And greatness grows from the humble soil. So never stop dreaming.
Never stop dreaming and always prioritize your education and furthering your personal development. That is the message from the Chief Executive Officer of Sub-Saharan Africa at the Big Five Duty Free Business, Lloyd Mhlanga. He joined us today for our Executive Lounge. Thank you so much, Lloyd. It's been absolutely lovely getting to know you a little bit better.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights. SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That is the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you can go back and revisit the conversations. They'll be made available as podcasts for you to listen to. Of course, we'll see if we can keep you updated on those investigations by the Standing Committee of Public Accounts around the Road Accident Fund. But also, if we are able to get hold of the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, perhaps they can shed some more light on their revision of the Transformation Fund and what it is they're hoping to achieve. But for right now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. It also means from my side, good night.